Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello folks, it's Ben. You're listening to my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Hope you're okay in the midst of all this insanity. Thanks for tuning in. That's some archaic radio vernacular right there. I'd love it if you drop off a very brief review on iTunes when you've got a minute. You can, if you choose to, help support the podcast by signing up for a small recurring monthly subscription at bensmithphoto.com/smallvoice, or you can make a one-off donation. If you need a spanking new Squarespace website but you don't have the time or the inclination to figure out how to do it yourself, I will happily do it for you. And get in now, because the price is soon going up to what will still be a bargain, but it will be less of a bargain than it is at the moment, if you can see what I mean. This is episode 73. It's part two of the chat I had with photojournalist turned educator Paul Lowe, and it is sponsored by the thoroughly awesome folks at the Charcoal Book Club, the world's first book of the month club dedicated exclusively to photo books. The way it works is that each month Charcoal works with the most respected photographers and publishers in the industry to send hand-picked books directly to your door. Whether you're a professional artist or a photographer with a stock library, or a novice who's just beginning to build their collection, Charcoal Book Club is an easy and affordable way to stay up to date on the most essential work in contemporary photography. The club offers free shipping to the UK, Canada and the US, and members get exclusive perks such as signed copies, access to rare titles and more. As I mentioned last time, February's Book of the Month, guest curated by the brilliant Todd Hydo, is all about Soul Lighter. This book looks awesome. How good was Soul Lighter? This is a very comprehensive overview of his whole career. It looks like it's been brilliantly curated. And if you want it, as you should, as I do, you can sign up to Charcoal Book Club and you will get it delivered to you. For a very limited period only, Charcoal are extending a special introductory offer to Small Voice listeners, a 10% discount on your membership when you sign up at charcoalbookclub.com using the special code ASMALLVOICE. So for the latest and greatest photo books delivered to your door with free shipping and no hassles, check out the charcoalbookclub.com, where they're on a mission to inform the mind and inspire the soul. So if you haven't already listened to part one of the Paul Lowe interview two episodes ago, you might want to do that. This is part two. Paul is a reader in documentary photography and the course leader of the Master's Programme in Photojournalism and Documentary Photography at the London College of Communication, the University of the Arts. Before electing to put his cameras away in favour of a life in academia, Paul was an award-winning news and documentary photographer with several World Press Awards under his belt and many years of experience covering breaking news the world over, including the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Romanian Revolution, Nelson Mandela's release, famine in Africa, the conflict in the former Yugoslavia, and the destruction of Grozny during the war in Chechnya. His pictures have appeared in such esteemed publications as Time, Newsweek, Life, the Sunday Times Magazine, The Observer and The Independent, among others. His book Bosnians, documenting 10 years of the war and post-war situation in Bosnia, was published in April 2005 by Saki Books. His research interest focuses on the photography of conflict, and he has contributed chapters to the books Picturing Atrocity, Photography and Crisis, and Photography and Conflict. His most recent books include Photography Masterclass, published by Thames and Hudson, and Understanding Photojournalism, co-authored with Dr. Jenny Good, and published by Bloomsbury Academic Press. So in part two, Paul touches on a number of interesting topics, including his transition from jobbing photojournalist to teaching and academic research. I think it's quite unusual for someone to have experience in both of those arenas, and as such, I found it really fascinating to hear Paul's perspective on some of this stuff. Here's part two of Paul Lowe. We should talk about Bosnia, because yes, it's very much...
It's been pretty defining in my life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. How did you... initially find yourself going? The war had already begun, I presume.
Yeah, well, I'd covered the Slovenian, in fact, I'd been out to what was still Yugoslavia in late 88, early 89 for the European, because the things were beginning, you know, the nationalism was on the rise and so on. I'd been to Belgrade and I'd been to Croatia and Belgrade and Zagreb, and I didn't actually get to Sarajevo on that trip, but I did do a road trip through what became Bosnia. And people are always saying, oh, Sarajevo, it's so mixed, you know, it's everybody's there. There'll never be a war there because, you know, it's so complicated. You've got, you know, Muslims and Serbs and Croats all living together, and it's this kind of wonderful civic center. So there was a sense that it was never going to happen there. But obviously it did. So I covered the very brief and in retrospect rather phony war in Slovenia, which is my first. I mean, obviously the Romanian Revolution was quite intense, but it was mostly small arms, whereas Slovenia was the first time I'd seen kind of tanks and, you know, jets and that kind of thing in action and so on. And then covered the beginnings of the conflict in Croatia, particularly around Osijek and Vukovar. And you know, they were good stories. I was interested in them. It was kind of part of what was going on in European history. And it was kind of following this trail that I'd been following from, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall onwards, really, of the kind of breakup of Eastern Europe and the rise of nationalism and so on. So initially, Bosnia was just another step in that journey, just another kind of domino in that really. And I went out with Tom Stoddard, in fact, in 92, in the summer of 92, to Sarajevo. We drove in together from Split. Like many journalists and reporters, you know, we were completely captivated and, you know, taken over really by the story, because it was this incredible, powerful human story. I always try to analyze what is it that's unique about the situation. To me, what was unique was not that there were soldiers fighting, because you find that in all sorts of situations, but that you had this very modern, culturally very advanced European city full of people like you and me, you know, who had the same sort of cultural references. You know, they, for some bizarre reason, British surreal humor was very popular in the former Yugoslavia. So, you know, Monty Python and Only Fools and Horses and Alo Alo were very popular TV series. In fact, they had their own sort of Sarajevan version called Nadalista, which was the kind of their version of Monty Python. So you'd be sitting in a kind of, you know, cellar in candlelight with shells falling, discussing the finer points of the Four Yorkshiremen sketch, you know, things like that. So, you know, there was this real sense of connecting with the people there. And, you know, there were lots of, you know, artists and musicians and you know, so basically it was a huge psychological experiment in what happens to modern man when they're reduced to almost a medieval state of existence. And how do people survive? How do people indeed prosper in that? And what was very uplifting was this sense that they didn't just sort of huddle together in the cellars waiting to be killed, but they actually actively resisted the aggression by celebrating civic values, by doing things that we do as civilized human beings. So, as I said, you know, going to music concerts, small recitals that would be set up by word of mouth with a string quartet that would play in an abandoned warehouse or something, because they couldn't broadcast it, because obviously the Serbs would know where it was going to happen. They might shell it, so it was all kind of word of mouth. Or, you know, an arts group that carried on, you know, with a war cinema and putting on small exhibitions when they could, and Susan Sontag coming to direct, you know, Waiting for Godot and things like that. And then also the incredible invention of people just on an ordinary level of, you know, if you've got to carry 30 litres of water and some firewood from a pump because all the water's been cut off in your house, and you've got to carry that a kilometre back to your house. How do you do that? You know, so that's 30 kilos of weight. You know, so people built all these incredible contraptions of old shopping trolleys and prams and sledges and things like that. So it was this kind of Heath Robinson invention, really. And it was incredibly powerful experience to see people, you know, denying the aggression by doing things that make us human, you know, being with friends, obviously, you know, creating cultural, creative things in all sorts of different ways. And obviously also going to the front lines to fight and to defend their city. You know? One of my best friends there was a guy called Shoba, Nebojša Shoba, who was a student. I met him in the Art Academy as a student. And, you know, he would spend 3 days in the academy making art in reference to the war, you know, sculptures from bits of shrapnel and helmets. And then he would go up to the front lines for 3 days and fight and then come back again. And that was the rhythm of his life during the war.
Mm. But you were less drawn to the sort of actual fighting, as it were, as a photographer, and more drawn towards...
Yeah, I mean, I always try to... One of the things I always try and think about is, you know, what can I do that nobody else is doing? You know, what angle on this story can I find that is either not being reported or is underreported or is going to make things different? And so with that story, as I said, I really felt a connection to the kind of create, if you like, this sense of civic values, if you like. So, I mean, Tom did some fantastic work as well on the survive, you know, on kind of surviving during the siege, as did lots of other people. And Gilles' work is absolutely brilliant as well. But, you know, I felt there's a gap to be filled there on particularly documenting the kind of the daily life of the siege. So I called it a survivor's guide. So it was looking at all these different strategies that people used to get through the event over that period of time. And so that was my kind of rationale for what I was doing there. And I, you know, I was there, you know, between 92 and 95, I went and I would go for a couple of weeks, come back, do some other stories. In fact, I went to Somalia in the intervening period. So I went to Sarajevo, came back, then went to Somalia, and then came back to Somalia again, then went back to Sarajevo in the beginning of 93 after that. And then I would go back and forwards, you know, for a couple of weeks at a time, a month at a time sometimes, go and do another story in the intermediate period, come back again, and so on and so forth.
So you were sort of in your element as in a way, but was there, did you feel that there was any kind of a psychological toll being taken?
On myself, I mean, I think, you know, because... I think I've tried to deal with these things. I mean, obviously there is, it's difficult, you know, you're seeing some pretty horrendous things, but in almost all these situations, there has been this kind of spark of humanity. So you see terrible things, but you also see amazing things. So, you know, you're witnessing doctors in the hospital doing incredible, you know, acts, saving people's lives with almost nothing, no anesthetic, no electricity, no hot water, and working, you know, 24-hour shifts, you know, to save people's lives. And you see, you know, people being incredibly creative and brave and innovative and intelligent and human and funny, even in these kind of very adverse situations. So you're seeing the worst of things and the best of things. And so that sense of kind of the strength of the human spirit, even in these incredible adversity. I mean, it sounds a bit of a cliche, but I always try to think about showing what happens to ordinary people in these extraordinary situations and kind of how to document that. Mm. Like a lot of my generation, so people like Alan Little and Christian Amanpour and, you know, obviously, you know, to a lesser extent, Tom, because Tom was already pretty well established by that period, but people like Roger and myself, Roger Hutchins, and it was our war, you know, Ron Haviv. It was kind of really where we, you know, came of age, really, I think, as journalists and as photographers. But it was also very frustrating because, you know, we were obviously collectively putting forward this idea that what was happening there was a serious act of aggression by one very well-armed and organized state, effectively, against a relatively unprepared and ill-armed, emergent nation that didn't have any of the infrastructure and the weapons that the other side had. And so things like the arms embargo that was imposed, you know, we saw as extremely... problematic and unfair, and you know, Western intervention we thought could have solved things very, very quickly because we, you know, I think we saw the Serb side, the Republika Srpska and its Serbian backers, as a bit of a paper tiger, really, that if we had stood up to it with any kind of level of resistance from the West in terms of the UN and so on, intervention could have succeeded in bringing an end to it very, very quickly. But that wasn't the line that was being put forward by the Western embassies and the governments and, you know, the French and the British and the Americans particularly. They were trying to put forward this ancient ethnic hatreds and all the sides are the same and everyone's to blame and so on and so forth. So as journalists, it was a very frustrating story to cover because you were doing your job, as it were, of telling the story as loudly and as accurately as you could. But the response to that, in what we all felt was a kind of pretty straightforward case, didn't happen. So there was a lot of, you know, this whole idea of Martin Bell's idea, the journalism of attachment, and this sort of whole kind of more move towards kind of advocacy, if you like, or human rights work, I think in some ways kind of came out of that experience of frustration in terms of the lack of Western response or the lack of public response even as well to what was happening there.
Because you, as journalists, you felt that, you know, for once this was a fairly straight, this could have been sorted out reasonably
and
easily.
It was happening in Europe.
Yeah.
You know, this is, you know, a few hours drive from the capitals of Europe.
Yeah.
You know, this is not, you know, this is very much part of our world. And you know, if you don't stop it here, then, you know, it could spread. Mm. It could happen almost anywhere, you know.
Did that frustration change the way that you then were working afterwards?
I think it changed quite a lot of us. I mean, I think if you look at someone like Gary Knight or Gilles, you know, in the Kosovo situation, for example, they very overtly aligned themselves with a kind of human rights agenda and almost worked more like investigative photographers, kind of almost forensically than journalists. In my own regard, I think I came out of that, you know, that period, and it's not just Bosnia, but I came out of that whole kind of period feeling that, you know, coming back to the point I made earlier on, that there wasn't much point or value in me going where everybody else was going. So if I was going to do something, it would be to do something that wasn't being reported by anybody else, in a sense. I mean, I had a very kind of very, very uncomfortable moment in Kosovo in 99. I hadn't really covered the Kosovo situation very much, but when the Serbs started evicting and cleansing Kosovo, I felt, because I'd covered that whole story so much, I'd never read on the Kosovo element of it, that was the final kind of chapter in it, really. So I did go out to Albania and Macedonia and photograph the refugees coming over the border. And it was quite a traumatic experience because I was standing, you know, with a lot of other journalists and photographers who, as I said earlier on, they have every right to be there. But, you know, these people were coming over the border, you know, having been, you know, evicted at gunpoint from their homes with all, just literally what they could carry, exhausted. They'd had to walk several kilometers across no man's land or even more than that. And the first thing they saw was a journalist asking them, how do you feel? You know, not somebody welcoming them with open arms. So, and to be honest, by that point as well, I'd met, you know, my wife, and who's from Sarajevo, you know, and we'd met during the war. And then, you know, we'd come to live in the UK after the war. And I was watching these people coming over the border thinking, you know, that could have been my wife and her family if things had gone slightly differently, if Sarajevo had fallen, you know, the siege had, if the Serbs had managed to break through, you know, at any point and the city had fallen. So there was a kind of strong kind of personal feeling out of that. And I kind of had a little bit of a moment there of sort of feeling that I didn't want to do these big kind of news stories in that way anymore, even though I'd gone and I did my own thing. I did my own story there about, you know, what the refugees were carrying with them. I did portraits of the refugees and the things they'd managed to salvage and so on. But I did feel that, you know, what was the point of me? I mean, not what's the point of journalists and photographers being at these situations, but what am I so arrogant to think that my voice is so important that, you know, it's more important than anybody else's. And so from that point on, I thought, well, I only really want to cover stories where I can feel like I'm covering something that isn't otherwise being covered. You know, I'm not making a difference, but I'm doing things that would otherwise go unreported.
Right. So how far away at that stage were you from quitting altogether?
I was still very much wanted to be a photographer, you know, working in documentary and photojournalism. In fact, we'd moved back to Sarajevo in 2000. And I actually thought originally I was going to do a kind of big documentary project on the whole Balkan region. But in the end, and I wasn't really planning to work in Bosnia, actually, because I didn't really see what the story was. But then I went out one day by chance, really, with a team from the Bosnian Commission for Missing Persons, who were still recovering the remains of tens of thousands of people who'd been killed in various different massacres, not just Srebrenica, but a whole range of these, you know, larger and smaller massacres across the country. And this was 5 years after the end of the war, and we went out with a day and we found the remains of this family, a group of brothers who'd been killed trying to escape from Srebrenica, and their bodies had just lain out in the open for 5 years, and the bones were, you know, rotting away in the field. And it was a very powerful moment for me because it made me realize that there was a story here to be done that wasn't being told, which was kind of what was happening post-war, really. And that then led me to do the book, the first big major book I did, which is Bosnians, which is a kind of two-part story, the first half from the war and then the second half of the post-war, kind of, you know, the search for the missing, the return of people to their refugees, to their homes they've been cleansed from, and then the beginnings of kind of coming back to some sort of semblance of a more normal life. And so I spent the next 4 or 5 years really doing that story, kind of, you know, shooting it, you know, steadily over that period.
And you had a very, you know, a much more personal take on it in a way by then, because as you say, your wife was from there, so, yeah, you know, yeah, that must have...
Yeah, and yeah, absolutely. And I think there are quite a lot of us who became sort of, inverted commas, fellow travellers in the story. And yeah, I mean, I kind of, you know, Bosnia now is, I suppose, in some ways my second home. Sarajevo, I spend as much time there probably as I do in London. And, you know, we've got a lot of connections there, a lot of friends, and it's a city there. You know, I love the city. It's still kind of slightly exotic. It's still this kind of melting pot of East and West. The country has a lot of problems, undoubtedly, but it's also a great place to, just in terms of the quality of daily life there, you know, it's a wonderful place to hang out. And I find that, you know, literally you feel like history is still relevant to you as you walk down the streets of the city. You know, it's endlessly fascinating from that point of view. And I've kind of done quite a lot of, you know, I've done various things to try and kind of keep Sarajevo going in that sense, in my own small way. You know, we currently run a conference program that's called Why Remember, about history and memory and media and culture. So we're having an annual conference there, bringing together a whole range of different types of voices of, you know, academics and practitioners and historians and filmmakers and all different kind of voices and things like that. So it's important for me to kind of keep my professional connection with the city as well as a personal one.
Yeah, yeah. Were you getting interested in academia at that stage? Or did that come much later?
I wasn't necessarily getting interested in academia, but I was doing quite a lot of workshops and teaching. And I was doing work with the World Press Photo Foundation and helping them develop some of their educational programs and so on. And so, you know, when the basically I started doing a bit of teaching at Bolton in 93, 94, I think, because we were living in the UK at the time. My mum was, as I said earlier on, from living up in a small village in Lancashire. So I started teaching at Bolton, partly as a way of kind of seeing my mum more frequently. So I'd go up there once a week to teach a couple of days there and spend the night with my mum and to see her a little bit, because she was getting a bit old and a bit infirm. And so I did a year of teaching there at the photography course there. And then,
so that was quite early on. That was
about 2003, 2004. Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. And that was kind of my first sort of foray properly into the academic world. And then I met with Patrick Sutherland because he'd just become a reader, which is what I've just become, which is a more research orientated role at LCC, which was then still called London College of Printing. And I'd heard on the grapevine that he was looking for someone to perhaps start working with him to maybe take over the course. And I thought that was quite an interesting idea and quite a challenging thing to do. So I remember we had a coffee in Pret a Manger in Clerkenwell and ended up talking for about 3 hours about things. And so I started working a bit on what was then the postgraduate diploma in photojournalism. And they'd wanted to upgrade that to a master's level. And so I got involved in helping them write the program for that. And that was kind of my entry point really into the proper university life. Because when the job came up, when it was advertised, they applied for it and thankfully was given the post of running the course. So that was my kind of my entry point really into the proper academic world.
Almost serendipity really in a way.
It was kind of right place, right time thing, which is, I mean, I've always lived my life by that sort of philosophy, to be honest with you, of kind of, you know, make the most of the opportunities that come in front of you and kind of seize the day, as it were, because if you don't, then, you know, think, and so all that kind of better to regret what you did than what you didn't, as it were.
Yeah, yeah.
I kind of put myself in the right place at the right time. And I've kind of become a believer in kind of reinvention and rethinking what you do periodically. So I kind of, I suppose, on a kind of 10-year-ish basis, really, I suppose. Mm. So I had 10 years, more or less, as a news photographer, photojournalist, then sort of 10 years as a practice teacher, in other words, running the MA. And then I've now shifted over the last few years much more into a kind of research, writing, critical, historical perspective on things. And I think that's, at the moment, I think that's going to be the bulk of what I'm going to do for the next 10 years.
You know? Yeah, yeah. And I guess the inevitable question for me is whether you miss taking pictures.
Yeah, people ask me that all the time. to be honest, at the moment, I don't really, because what I do, I mean, first of all, I made a decision, you know, when I'd started the course, that I really felt that, coming back to the point I made earlier on, what can I do that is unique and that can make a difference? And I felt that what I could do was develop this course and kind of help instill or train or go work with a group of people to get across this idea of, I talked about earlier on, of this kind of this sense of what makes a good photographer from my perspective. And I've, you know, now the course has been running as an MA now, it started in 2005, and we've run the online version of it from 2008. So we put through hundreds of students. I mean, probably getting on for 500 people have done the course in that period, never mind the ones that did it before that when Patrick was running it. And I do think we've built a real legacy of very, very good practitioners who've got intelligent and sophisticated and well thought through and individual approaches to the documentary world and photojournalism and so on. And so I think we have had an impact, you know, as a program. I'd like to think we've influenced a range of different you know, areas and different photographers and so on. And that's been kind of that to me, I felt that was more important to do that than my own contribution, whatever that might have been. Mm. So that's been very motivating over the period of time. Mm. There's also a logistical side to it that, you know, I've got a family now and a wife and kids and I've, as we said, now I've got a new puppy, which means that the days when I could, you know, it's very stressful living that kind of the active photographer's life. You know, you're going to, the kind of stories I was doing, the kind of way I was working would mean being away for extended periods of time, very often at short notice. You know, the phone rings and it's like, can you be in Outer Mongolia tomorrow? You know, and you don't know when you're going to come back. And that's just too much, I think, with it, or for me anyway, at this stage of my life, that was too much for a for a family and so on. And then also, to be perfectly honest, I actually really enjoy the academic side of things. I mean, I've done my PhD now, which was on the photography of the former of the conflict in former Yugoslavia. I'm starting to do a lot of books, you know, getting things published, got a couple of textbooks coming out, editing books and so on. And I actually really enjoy that process. I enjoy the research process. I enjoy finding out things that perhaps haven't quite been noticed. And so they're kind of the old school historical research of going into archives and digging into boxes at the Imperial War Museum and finding the original dope sheets from the photographers that covered the liberation of Belsen. I find that really exciting. Mm-hmm. You know, and kind of discovering things that perhaps haven't been quite noticed and so on. And so, as I said, kind of coming full circle, you know, coming back to essentially a career that I could have possibly had if I'd got a first at Cambridge instead of a 2-2, maybe I would have become a historian all that time ago.
Mm.
So I find that very exciting, and I find it very motivating, and I'm finding I'm turning out to be reasonably good at it. So, and again, it comes back to this thing of what can I do that is unique? And one of the things I've tried to do a lot is bridge this gap between the kind of practice world and the world of photographers and the world of the academy, and act as a kind of a translator, if you like, or as a kind of bridging that gap, kind of, because often, you know, photographers and academics don't quite understand each other. And I think it's important that academics understand practice, but equally that photographers and practitioners understand the kind of critical discourses and the analysis of what they're doing. Coming back to some of the points you're making on about the ethics, for example, you know.
Mm.
And so I've tried to do things that bridge that gap, whether it's events, whether it's bringing together different kinds of voices of people, whether it's talking about photography within academic context, you know, so that the kind of theory people or the historians actually get it and they understand what it means to be a photographer and what it means to be in the field and how we work in the field, you know.
Do you spend a fair amount of time talking to your students about the ethical issues? There's been, you know, it's quite a topical.
Yeah,
there's
yeah,
been
yeah.
Now, obviously, that we're very much in the digital world and you know, the kind of Photoshop world and the way in which images can be easily manipulated. Mm-hmm. There've been a number of kind of high-profile cases. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that to some extent?
Well, one of the most important things to bear in mind is none of this is new.
Yeah.
And I've just done this new book, 1001 Photographs to See Before You Die, which the title is kind of, it's part of that series, 1001 Somethings to Do Before You Die. But one of the things I'd had to do for that was to look at a lot of 19th century photography, which I hadn't really done a deep dive into before. But it was fascinating to see the way that a lot of the debates that we think of today as being very kind of contemporary and of the moment actually were happening back then. So, you know, in those days, you know, there were people who were staging photography, they were doing composites, they were, you know, overlaying one image over another one, so, you know, because you couldn't actually physically record the sky and the ground at the same time and the same negative. So you had to do a combination print to be able to get detail in the sky and detail in the land. And, you know, obviously Roger Fenton's picture from the Crimea, you know, Alexander Gardner's picture of the rebel sharpshooter. There are lots of situations that are ethically complex in the 19th century. So most of the questions that we're dealing with today of truth and representation and authenticity and manipulation and staging have actually already been worked through or it's thought about. So it's not this is a new thing in the history of photography by any stretch of the imagination. And in fact, the fundamental, you know, questions haven't really changed that much. You know, and you've got examples all the way through the history of photography of photographers, you know. I think the big question is the authenticity of the work. You know, what are you trying to achieve? What's the, you know, Eugene Smith, who's often seen as one of the great founding fathers of the medium, you know, regularly staged photographs, regularly combined images. His work in the darkroom was, you know, I mean, these days would be considered to be absolutely, you know, beyond the pale, particularly in American practice. I think one of the problems, though, at the moment is we are almost getting into this almost kind of witch hunt culture where I don't want to go into specific cases and, you know, because every case has its own set of problems, but we're in danger of having this kind of, you can't do anything, you know, and it's almost becomes impossible to work, you know. I mean, you can't, it's almost the point where even being a human being, you know, is no longer allowed because you're intervening in the situation, you're changing what might have happened. And of course, everything you do is changing the situation. Everything you do is kind of, you can't pretend that you're invisible. So I think we have to just be careful about kind of getting into a witch hunt mentality.
Mm.
Obviously, if people are clearly doing things that are, unethical, then we have to call them out on that. But there are some very, but a lot of the time it's very grey, and some of these cases that are happening at the moment, you really have to question what the agenda is in terms of what's happened and so on.
Yeah, there does seem to be a certain amount of confusion. But there, obviously there are cases when it is pretty clear. I mean, yeah. if you flat out bullshit about the about where the picture was taken,
of course.
Clearly that's, that needs to be called out, as you said.
Absolutely.
That's interesting, all that stuff. But yeah, no, it's definitely kind of a top, kind of quite near the top of the agenda, some of these things. Mm-hmm. But just, it seems like some people get called out and then other people don't, and then it's a, there seems to be,
that's also part of the problem, because you know there are some very, very high profile names who've been called out recently, and seemingly the impact on their career has been negligible, whereas there are some other people who have been accused of what I consider to be relatively, in fact, not even problems, things that, why, of course you would have done that, who've been severely sanctioned by that. And you do have to question about what is the broader agenda around this. You know, let's be equitable about these things.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, that happens in every walk of life, but it's kind of, when it's happening in your own particular world, it is quite problematic.
Mm. Well, it seems like no one's quite, in terms of the organisations, you know, people running prizes and that, it seems like no one's quite got the moral courage to go, well, this seems all right to me. It's like everyone's like, whoa, out from under it. But do you think, some people have sort of suggested that maybe it's the young photographers are putting pressure on themselves because of wanting to win prizes and stuff. Is there an element of that?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say, because I don't think many people go out to do a particular story hoping to win a prize with it.
No.
I mean, you know, one would hope that's not the motivation. But obviously the competition world has its own dynamic and its own set of problematics. And, you know, I think there are some photographers who quite admirably refuse to enter competitions for those reasons, because they don't want to, it's not a get, you know, we're not in this to win prizes, you know, in theory. On the other hand, you know, obviously I've entered them in the past, and probably would do again if I had a body of work I thought was relevant, because it is still, actually, if you think about them in terms of the broader role of disseminating work, competitions play a very important role nowadays, I mean, especially World Press, in getting what we do out into the public domain. I mean, you know, if you look at the World Press photo exhibition and book, you know, you might critique it in certain ways, but it has an incredible footfall. You know, a lot of people get to see that, and a lot of people get to see it who would not otherwise be exposed to that kind of work in that kind of context. So I think the competitions still do have an important role. They also have an important role in kind of acting as kind of weather vanes about where we're going, where the industry is going, what kind of trends. If you look back at the history of World Press, or POY for that matter, it's a fascinating kind of documentation, the trajectory of what we're interested in, what the world is interested in. So there's a lot of valuable, kind of, as a historian, there's a lot of valuable material in there to look back on. So I think they still perform an important role. It has kind of, it's a bit of a Pandora's box, though, because this explosion of grants and foundations and funding and competitions, some of which have got very good, you know, ethical codes, some of which are slightly problematic, some competition, some funding calls are very kind of well worked out, some are not. So it is a difficult world. But on the other hand, it's giving a whole range of new ways of getting work out there and getting work done that didn't exist 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, and like you say, I mean, if you're a photographer who's, you know, interested in, you know, the kind of these social issues, it is a way to, for the story itself to,
absolutely, yeah,
you know,
absolutely,
get exposure.
And I think that's the big difference. As we said earlier on, you know, the thing that I push mostly with my students is that, you know, in the old days, we got our magazine story published in the magazine, and we saw that as the be-all and end-all. But so what? You know, I mean, great, you got a story in The Guardian. Who saw it? Who actually read it? You know, you've got no idea who was involved in that. Whereas now you're seeing more and more photographers putting together, being the kind of central fulcrum, if you like, of a much more complex project where you've got, you know, you're working with a couple of editorial clients to get that high profile visibility. You may be working with an NGO or a humanitarian organization on a particular issue to get you the access. You're working with a funding body, whether that's commercial or whether it's an independent funding body. You're working perhaps with a gallery. You may be working with a book publisher. And you're trying to get your story out to a particular audience across a whole range of different outlets. So it's a much more focused and targeted and intelligent strategy, really, for getting your work out there. Mm. And that's what we try to encourage with our graduates, obviously, is having this much more sophisticated and thinking very much about who's the audience, who am I trying to impact with this work and why? And what am I trying to do with that information? You know, am I going to give them something to do once they've found out about this situation? So having a much more sophisticated strategy, really, of getting, of why you're doing the work, who you're doing the work for, and what impact might that work have when it gets out into the public domain. And that's the big shift, I think. I mean, people were doing that before, obviously, but I think nowadays the potential for that is much greater, and you've got a lot more tools in you, at your disposal to get your message out there into the world to the people that I might actually be able to do something about it when they hear it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's that, and but it's also this thing that we alluded to earlier, which is this kind of move towards that grey area where, you know, documentary and fine art mm-hmm. kind of meet, and people are exploring absolutely. That. Yeah. Do you think that photojournalism, in a sense, is out of fashion in the way that we used to think of it?
I it's hard to say. I think when photojournalism gets out into the kind of, you know, the public domain, very often the response to it is very powerful. So it might be sort of within the kind of photographic ghetto seen to be slightly unfashionable, but when you go out into the kind of, you know, real world, invariably it has a very good impact, you know, because that kind of relatively visually accessible, as it were, storytelling, I think still has a great impact on people. Mm. Particularly when it's done at a very high level, and it's done with a level of integrity and sophistication, and as we discussed earlier on. But I think there are also, you know, as we said, you know, lots of other visual forms. You know, there's a whole kind of grade, really, from kind of old school, you know, documentary photojournalism right through to this kind of, as we said, whatever we want to call it, but fine art documentary, for want of a better phrase. And I think the great thing about that is that there's so much more freedom now to find your own individual unique voice and have that kind of to be successful than there was, you know, when I was working, to be honest with you, because it was very much a kind of gulf between, there was kind of, you know, fine art on one end and photojournalism on the other, and almost nothing in between. And whereas now, and I think, you know, someone like Martin Parr and to an extent Simon, you know, Norfolk have done a lot to make this happen, because they managed to operate in the middle between those spaces and operate seamlessly almost between the editorial market and the gallery market and the publisher, the book publishing market, and so on, and create bodies of work that can work across a range of different kind of spaces, and that use the language of different spaces as well to kind of, you know, operate yeah. in that way. So I think, you know, the terrain has shifted fundamentally. That's the big difference for me, that gap that used to be a gulf, I think almost is almost irrelevant now.
Yeah.
You know, and so work can be much more mobile across a range of different spaces. Right.
Yeah, because I was thinking about the kind of visual grammar that yeah. used to be, yeah. you know, kind of dominant in the times when you were at your sure. height. You know, yeah. if you look at those World Press books, everyone
absolutely,
was basically
yeah.
shooting, you know,
yeah,
in a similar
exactly,
way.
Yeah, absolutely,
and that isn't
yeah,
the case
yeah.
anymore.
And exactly. I mean, and to be frank, I think World Press has struggled with that in a way, because obviously as you move more across that spectrum, then things like the role of the photographer, I mean, you know, documentary portraiture, for example, is a good, you know, there's been a huge growth in that as a genre, if you like. But obviously, that predominantly that's staged, you know. So, but what do you have to say in every single picture that's clearly a documentary portrait? This picture was staged. Mm. Well, that seems ridiculous. I mean, you know, if you look at an Annie Leibovitz, then obviously you say, okay, this picture was staged. But if you look at the work of someone like, say, Zio Gafic, who does a beautiful portrait of a young Bosnian man who's about to jump into a, you know, in a jumping competition, who's just poised there perfectly. Do you have to say in the caption of that, this picture was staged? Mm-hmm. I mean, it just seems
ridiculous.
It seems ridiculous. Exactly.
But then
yeah.
you get into a sort of semantic pedantry about
exactly.
what
yeah,
staged
exactly.
is. And
then obviously you go back to the absolutely fundamentals of every photograph is staged, because
yeah.
no photograph. Right. We treat the inverted commas, you know, photojournalistic aesthetic as if it is neutral, as if it just exists in the world. And of course it doesn't. You know, mm. I mean, every single photograph is a two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional space mm-hmm. where the photographer's made thousands of micro and macro choices about what is going to be seen, you know. So every picture is staged, mm. and so all these things, you know, if you go to if you try and think about this in a kind of any logical philosophical sense, then it's a house of cards that collapses immediately, because
yeah.
it's just the variations on a shades of
yeah.
of gray, as it were. You know?
And but obviously you obviously clearly you love thinking about all this stuff, because mm-hmm, for mm-hmm. you know, as a practitioner who's now
yeah.
turned into an educator, it's sort of really kind of meat and drink
absolutely
for you.
Yeah, and I enjoy that process of trying to, as I said, I mean, I think I see a lot of my role now as questioning a lot of these things and trying to think through them, and think through them with photographs. And that's one of the big things, is actually use the images themselves as the tools to help think through these problems and interrogate them, you know, and think about them, and think about them, as I said, from the practitioner's point of view. How did that picture get made? You know, what does it do? How does it work? How does it operate? How does it relate to other things around it, and so on? So actually, and trying to kind of bridge that gap, really, as I said earlier on.
Do you have certain kind of go-to projects that you like to share with your students that you can think of, certain book projects or pieces of work?
Let me think. What do I show a lot? One project just immediately comes to mind that I show a lot in the portraits side of things is Jan Banning's Bureaucrats, because to me that just seems to be like one of the most elegant ways to kind of get across this idea of the documentary portrait and an intelligent project, where, if people aren't familiar with it, Jan, you know, did this whole incredible body of work where he photographed middle level and junior level bureaucrats across the world and just showed through a very similar style of every picture shot in more or less the same way, just their office spaces, and kind of just shows the difference between America and India and Russia. And it's a fantastic project, just very, very visual. And I use that one quite a lot in my teaching. I use Marcus Bleasdale quite a lot as a case study as well, because I think, you know, in terms of this idea of the photographer putting together a very coherent strategy for how to get his concerns and passions across, and doing it in a very sustained way over a long period of time, and kind of becoming an expert in a particular set of issues, and then also actually affecting some measurable change. I think he's a very good example of that process. So there are two that, I mean, I use lots of examples, obviously, but there are two that I do use quite frequently in class, just as a way of kind of getting across a very specific point.
Do you keep up with what's kind of coming out in terms of, you know, new people and new books?
I try to, but it's overwhelming.
It is.
But also because I'm going backwards a lot of the time, because a lot of the work I'm doing at the moment is quite historical.
Right.
You know, as I said, I'm just looking, I'm sort of toying with the idea of doing a new piece of work on the original founding members of Magnum, which is going to be if I do it, will be quite a big block of research to kind of find out, tease out their stories in the 1930s and so on. But yeah, and obviously you're trying to keep up as much as you can. But again, because it's got so much grayer now, then that means the field you've got to keep up with is practically everything.
Yeah, right, yeah.
But before you could, okay,
you
I'm keeping with photojournalism.
That's my niche now.
Exactly,
yeah,
now
yeah.
You've got to count. So it's quite tricky. So in a way, again, it comes back to, as I said before, you know, you do what you can do within that. And I've got quite interested in exploring certain historical moments. You know, I've done quite a lot on the liberation of the camps in 1945. You know, obviously I've done a lot on the war in the former Yugoslavia. I've got some of the little historical queries. There's a project I'm quietly working away on, which is trying to make sense of some of these challenged famous pictures like Capa's Furling Soldier and Gardner's Death of a Rebel Sharpshooter and Fenton's Crimea picture. I'm just trying to think about that from a practitioner's point of view about, okay, there's all the debates about whether they're staged or not, but actually, what actually might have happened, you know, in the field. You know, like with Fenton's picture, if people are familiar with, from the Crimea, of all the cannonballs in the valley, where there are two versions, one with the cannonballs in the middle of the road and one with them on the side. Just how did those cannonballs physically get moved, you know? Obviously, they are moved, but who moved them, you know? Because a cannonball is like a 12, 15-pound thing.
Yeah, and there's a lot of them.
And there's a lot of them. So yeah. Who did it, you know? Especially considering supposedly the place is under fire.
Yeah.
So, you know, how did they physically get moved from there to there? And how did he persuade, you know, him and his assistant or a bunch of soldiers to move them from back on? I mean, it's just,
just
the physical logistics of it, I query.
Do you find that your students kind of turn you on to photographers, you know, or certain pieces of work that you hadn't
aware? And very often we did a really good, interesting little experiment. We did an exchange with a school in Bielefeld, and we did an Instagram project with them where they started off by just having this Instagram conversation where they didn't know anything about the other person, but they just posted a picture each day in response to the other person's picture about their lives. We did that for a couple of weeks. Then we did another version of that where we asked them to post a picture by another photographer. They just did a screen grab of a book or of a website or whatever, and then share that and get the response. And some of the connections they made and some of the work that came out of that I'd never seen before, and it's like fascinating links and connections between different photographers from different periods, and some contemporary and some historical and so on. And because they were Germans, they were using a lot of German references, and so that was very interesting to kind of see that in there as well. So
where does social media fit into this modern picture as far as your
On a personal level, I don't use Instagram because I don't feel like I've got enough to feed it, and because it seems to be a beast. But I think for certain people, obviously, it's a very valuable tool, and again, it's just another platform, it's another way of getting your message out there. And I think, you know, essentially being able to have a kind of following, as it were, that is interested in what you're doing. It's a very direct connection. You know, when you post a picture on Instagram and it gets 50,000 likes, that 50,000 people have seen that picture and engaged with it. So it's a very immediate feedback loop for photographers that are using it well, and the same with Facebook and so on. So again, I think it comes back to this point that you've just got a whole range of dissemination vehicles now that you can get your work out across on. And it is a multi-platform world now. And I think if you are trying to affect change with your work and you're not trying to engage with the possibilities of those different forms, then you're not giving yourself the full justice, really.
Yeah. I was wondering if there's a sort of move towards people doing much more kind of personal work, personal in the sense that they're doing stuff that's, you know, kind of to do with them and their own world. Mm. And I'm just wondering whether maybe that's to do with the fact that no one's getting sent anywhere anymore. So you kind of, do you think there's a kind of connection there?
I think it's slightly, I'm not sure it's that, but I mean, certainly there is obviously a lot of work that is intensely personal. But very often that's because the people that are telling those stories have very interesting personal stories to tell. You know, Leonie Hampton, for example, who's one of the graduates from the course from when Patrick was there and now one of my main tutors, is doing this amazing body of work about her mother who has OCD.
Yeah.
And about how all the things she's hoarded over the years, and she's doing this really clever project using eBay, and she's catalogued every single object, and then she's going to resell them on eBay as a kind of, you know, participatory work with the audience. So, you know, she's photographing her own life, but because it's a really interesting question, and it's got a lot of social relevance to it. So I think opening up the personal is you're right, is definitely a trend. I mean, it's not new, obviously, you know, Nan Goldin, and you know, you can go back and see all sorts of previous examples of it. But I think it's, if you've got something interesting to talk about, if there's an important issue that's directly relevant to you in terms of your own family experience. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, you know, lots of novels are based on personal experience. Lots of other artworks are based on personal experience. So why shouldn't photography be so? So I think the rise of the personal, if you like, is partly because I think the personal is so much more part of what we do now. And maybe social media to an extent has opened that up, because we are, in a funny way, more integrated in people's daily lives than we used to be.
Mm. What are the kind of mistakes do you find you come across most commonly among your students?
Mistakes. I wouldn't say it's really mistakes. I mean, what we try to do a lot, we do try and mess with them quite a lot. So the way the course is designed is, in the middle of the course, we put them through a series of kind of exercises that really challenge who they are and where they are and what they're doing. We call it the Rethink Project, where we challenge the students to experiment, explore, and do something radically different. And we find that that's a real transformational experience. I hate to use that word, but they use it back to me a lot, so I kind of have to. That a lot of people who come in thinking, I want to be a photojournalist, or I want to be this, or I want to be that, go through this very kind of, you know, dramatic change, really, and they come out of it with often finding their own, we use it as a way of trying to help them find their own kind of voice, if you like, find their own real intense passion. And often it's something they didn't really realize was there before. And that, for me as an educator, is one of the most satisfying things that we do. I don't do it by myself. I do it with the group of us that work on the course. So, you know, Max Horton, Ed Clark, Lewis Bush, Jenny Good, Peter Fraser, you know, Leonie, all these other tutors that we work with. We're all quite conscious of trying to push people out of their comfort zone and get them to challenge their assumptions about what they do and why they do it and so on. And we found over the years that that's been a really, really powerful and effective vehicle for helping people find their own vision. So it's not a mistake as such, but it is, we do not in every case, obviously, but in quite a lot of cases have a real impact on their sense of what photography can do and what photography can be.
Mm. So you've just done a book with one of your fellow tutors, yes, Jennifer Good.
That's right. Yeah.
It's called Understanding Photojournalism. I kind of wish it had been around 20 years ago, Paul. I remember there's a book called Truth Needs No Ally by Howard Chapman.
That's right.
That's kind of the closest thing, I guess, that we had before. Mm. But it's, well, tell me what was the intention behind doing it, and what is it for?
Yeah, well, the intention, I mean, obviously, first of all, thanks very much to Bloomsbury for inviting us to do the book, because they saw that Bloomsbury has invested quite heavily in photography books recently, in kind of theory and textbooks and so on. And so it's great that they've got that list. And they approached Jenny and myself with this idea of doing a kind of critical introduction to photojournalism, because it was part of a series of other genres they're working on. And we saw it as a chance to, in some ways, kind of, you know, put that, set down the philosophy of the course in terms of the theory and the relationship of theory and history to practice that we teach, because we see them very much as integrated. We don't see them as separate things. And so we tried to kind of structure it around a series of positions and questions and themes that we thought were really relevant and important for any contemporary practitioner or photographer or people, somebody engaged with photojournalism, to think about and to take on board. So we're not trying to provide answers to these questions, but we're trying to set up a whole series of questions around the ethics of representation, around, you know, what we do, how we do it, what kind of position you might have in terms of the subject, you know, this, you know, all the arguments and discourses around colonialism. But also at the end, you know, the final chapter is a sort of bit of a kind of rallying cry, really, for the value of photojournalism, because, you know, it has been under siege, it has been under attack, particularly, you know, in the kind of 70s and 80s, the critical theory was very much anti-photojournalism. Thankfully, over the last decade or so, I think, you know, a lot of other writers and critics coming from other areas in photography have been very supportive, or have certainly taken photojournalism much more seriously in terms of what it does, the role it plays in civic discourse, and what it does in terms of helping people understand the world around them and some way codify and visualize that. So there's been a kind of groundswell of kind of critical writing that is more in favor of the value of kind of photojournalism. We wanted to reflect that. So we wanted to finish with a sort of rallying cry, really, and then going back to that idea I mentioned earlier on about sort of network of trusted witnesses, that photojournalism does still play an important part in telling us what's going on in the world and providing that information. But we also we're also asking the audience to be much more active in the process as well. So it's not just a passive sort of seeing a picture in the paper and, oh, well, isn't that terrible? But using it as a way to then open up a possible space where the audience might actually be given some options about what to do with that information and what to, how to take action on that knowledge. So it's kind of a defense, really, in some ways of the value of photojournalism. And I think as a book to read, hopefully it's written in a reasonably accessible style. It's not overly laden with theory. It deals with theory, but it's not, hopefully it's not
pretentious. I mean, it is intentionally quite an academic piece of work. So what do you think are the kind of defining challenges today for photojournalism kind of going forward?
Well, defining challenges. I mean, I think it's just trying to produce work that is, you know, as I said, authentic and relevant and that has some sort of sense of why, what are we trying to do? I mean, there's one argument that says that you don't need to think about that at all, because it's just important that it's there. You know, if we didn't have photojournalism, inverted commas, then what would the world be like? And if you imagine a world without photography, or imagine a world without photojournalism, would we be in a worse situation already? You know, so there's a sort of zero element to this where, you know, we don't know because we can't test it out. But, you know, imagine if there was no photojournalism in the world, where would we be then? So there's a sense where we just need to keep on doing what we're doing. But there is also a sense, I think, where the work needs to be, as I said earlier on, it needs to be intelligent, well-researched, visually engaging, socially concerned, and have an intelligent sense of who its audience is and what you're trying to do, what you're trying to get people to do with that knowledge. So having a slightly more strategic vision of what you're trying to achieve, I think, really.
Are you reasonably optimistic?
Well, you know, I every year we take on, a you know, 50 new students and every year 50 graduate. And, you know, looking back over 15 years, I mean, not just documentary, but across this range, this broad range of, you know, whatever we call it, documentary, photojournalism practice, I think, you know, I've seen, and also not just from my course, obviously, but lots of other places as well, you know, there are more photographers now doing interesting work than there were 20 years ago, you know, undoubtedly. And they're finding ways to make that work through whatever set of different strategies they put together to make work that is intelligent, challenging, visually sophisticated, relevant, authentic, and tells me something about the world that I didn't know before, or tells me in a way that I didn't think of before. So from that perspective, yes, I am optimistic. I think photography still has an important role to play. It's a more complex one. It's perhaps more nuanced. It's, you know, as I said before, we've opened up this huge new kind of Pandora's box of opportunities that didn't exist a generation ago. And quite where we go with that, quite what we do with it, is hard to say. But I think we are able to connect with audiences in a much more over and direct way than we were able to before. And, you know, I don't think photography, the Georges Didier Human, who's a French philosopher, says, you know, this, we simultaneously expect too much and too little of photography. So we shouldn't expect photography to change the world. Why should we? But equally, we shouldn't expect it to have no impact whatsoever. So as part of a process, I mean, you know, it's crazy to think that photography is the only thing that's going to make any difference. But as part of a process where it's linked to a whole range of other kind of action activities and outputs and so on. So as again coming back to this idea of a kind of network of trusted witnesses, you know, we're part of a social discourse where it's important that we carry on doing what we do, because if we don't, then, you know, we're missing a really, really important and relevant part of the puzzle. You know, if you're trying to make sense of what's going on in the world and argue for some sort of social change and social justice, I think photography has a very important role to play in that process. It's not the only thing, of course, but it's still got a very, very relevant and important and urgent role to play.
Well, Paul, thank you so much. I've enjoyed it a lot. It's good. Great to fill in some of those gaps and to hear your story, but also to hear your kind of academic perspective on everything. I really appreciate the amount of time that you've given me. And,
pleasure.
And thank you so much
it's
for doing it.
Very interesting for me as well. Thanks. Been a good session.
Good. Thanks,
thank
Paul.
Thank you very much.